Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live is a journalist who investigated the fast food practices of this country, despite the fact that meat packers and fast food companies wouldn't talk to him, but people did. He found somebody who told him the story about an explosion of a nuclear missile, in Arkansas. And out of that experience and the story has come this book called Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. Please welcome Eric Schlosser to West Coast Live. How do you do? Nice to see you. Thank you for coming in. There was, as with so many of these stories, there's an individual that's sort of at the heart of them, and you tell a compelling story here of a missile accident and what it means about nuclear safety. Tell us about Jeff Kennedy.
Jeff Kennedy was a missile maintenance guy. He was the person at the Little Rock Air Force Base who knew the most about how these aging intercontinental ballistic missiles worked. And he got called in the middle of the night to deal with this. And I write about the culture of the maintenance workers. In many ways, this book is a history from the bottom up. You had A. Scott Berg on, who I think is one of our great literary treasures, and an old school biographer who spends many years recreating an individual life. And in my own way, I've looked at the bottom, not at the presidents, not at famous editors. And those books are incredible. But what I've tried to do in all my work is take voices who haven't been heard in the mainstream. And so in writing about nuclear weapons, I mentioned presidents and former secretaries of defense who I interviewed. But what I really tried to do was show the day-in, day-out working of this nuclear weapon enterprise. So the voices in my book are of maintenance guys, bomb squad guys who were trained to, you know, diffuse damaged nuclear weapons, weapons designers, the bomber crews, launch officers. And Jeff Kennedy is one of those guys. And in looking back at the Cold War, and, you know, in many ways looking at the foot soldiers of the Cold War, there was remarkable personal heroism. There were people who risked their lives and sometimes lost them in order to prevent a nuclear catastrophe, in order to prevent a nuclear war. And Jeff Kennedy was one of those people. And I tried to honor his service in the book.
How did you come across him?
I came across the story of this nuclear weapons accident when I was spending time with the Air Force. And I was spending time with the Air Force Space Command and the United States Space Command. Most people don't realize we have space commands, but
it's important to command space.
Well, it is. It is. And if there's going to be a future, if there's going to be a war in the future between major industrialized nations, space is going to be where that war is going to be settled, probably, because our precision weapons are dependent on satellites, communications dependent on satellites. And our space command is all about how do we protect our satellites and perhaps destroy those of our enemies in any event. The officers of the space command had begun their careers often in intercontinental ballistic missile silos, and they started telling me stories of weapon accidents during the Cold War that just were incredible to me. And one of them was about this accident in Damascus, Arkansas, with an intercontinental ballistic missile. And Jeff Kennedy played a major role in trying to save this damaged missile from being part of a catastrophe. And I couldn't believe this story when I heard it. And it's remarkable. This was in the pre-internet age, but I looked in the phone book and I tracked him down in Maine and I called him up and he said, well, why don't you come over? And I drove up, you know, I was living in New York City at the time. I drove 6 or 7 hours and wound up spending a couple of days with him, hearing his story, hearing his involvement in our nuclear weapon program. And I really thought, well, there is a book in this story, but also in this overall subject.
You describe levels of heroism amongst people who are often not written about, and you have written about them, that these are the people who actually make things work or fail.
Yeah, and in this the story that's the central narrative of my book is about a Titan II missile, which was the biggest missile we ever built, and on top of it was the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever built. That one warhead on that one missile in Damascus, Arkansas in September of 1980, that one nuclear warhead had more than three times the explosive force of all the bombs used by all the militaries in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. So this was an extraordinarily powerful weapon.
What the heck was it doing in Damascus, Arkansas? I mean, I guess we planted them everywhere.
Yeah. Well, there was a congressman named Wilbur Mills who wanted to get more...
Fannie Fox.
Yeah, so he wound up being caught with a stripper in Washington, D.C. in the Tidal Basin. But before that happened to him, he wanted to bring business to Arkansas, and these Titan II missiles needed a home, and he persuaded the Air Force to put them there. And it was a very unlikely place to put the most powerful warheads ever built by the United States, because these silos were in rural communities with farms, you know, hundreds of yards or 1,000 yards away from them. But in any case, what happened was a workman was working in the silo and dropped a tool. And workmen dropped tools all the time in the silo, and it was a total hassle because they'd have to climb all the way down to the silo, get the tool, go back up to the top of the missile. But in this case, the workman dropped the tool. It was a socket. It fell about 80 feet, hit the silo wall, ricocheted, and hit the missile, and caused a fuel leak. And there was suddenly thousands of gallons of highly explosive fuel pouring into this silo, and with this powerful warhead on the missile.
He probably said, darn.
Yeah. Well, I signed something that said I can't actually say on the air what he probably said. But, you know, in that case, it was human error that led to a near nuclear catastrophe. And again, you find, you know, very simple, almost trivial acts. There was another case that I write about in the book in which a workman was working at a Minuteman site, Minuteman missile site. There had been a problem with the intruder alarm, and it wasn't working quite right, sort of like the burglar alarm at the missile site. And so a workman went out there, and he opened up the fuse box, and he's checking the fuses, and he'd forgotten to bring his fuse puller with him, so he just had a regular screwdriver, and he pulls out one fuse, puts it back, no problem, pulls out another fuse, no problem, puts it back, pulls out another fuse, and he hears a loud explosion. And by using the screwdriver, he had created a short circuit and had blown the warhead off of the missile. And in that case, the warhead did not detonate full scale.
But I thought there were control codes.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fuse box.
Yeah, it's a fuse box, and it's a very well-intended guy at the end of a long day using a screwdriver instead of using a fuse puller. And you wouldn't want to do that 10 to 15 times to see if the warhead would detonate. So in looking at the management of our arsenal, I'm trying to take this subject, firstly, which has been largely forgotten. Most people have stopped thinking about the fact that we have thousands of nuclear weapons, but also show how the interaction between technology and human beings can lead to all kinds of unfortunate things.
Well, also, I think, too, I mean, you've got Strategic Air Command, you've got Pentagon, then you've got local cultures where these missiles are parked.
Yeah. And what the book is about in many ways is about the management of a complex technological system. And I came to see that we're much better at devising and creating these complex systems than we are at managing them, controlling them, let alone what to do, knowing what to do about them when something goes wrong.
So command and control is a little ironic.
It is a little ironic, and it's actually a lot ironic. And if you look at the history of our nuclear weapons program, from the very beginning, this technology has been on the verge of slipping out of our control. When they were testing the first nuclear device in New Mexico in July of 1945, and this sounds like a joke, but it's true, the Manhattan Project scientists weren't sure when they detonated the first nuclear device whether the atmosphere would catch on fire. And if the atmosphere caught on fire, it would kill every living thing on Earth. And the physicist, Nobel Prize winning physicist Enrico Fermi, calculated the odds were 1 in 10 that the atmosphere would catch on fire. And they weren't sure if he was joking. So the scientists did calculations for a year to see if the atmosphere would catch on fire. And one of those scientists was a physicist named Victor Weisskopf. He was standing 10 miles away from the device in the desert of New Mexico when it detonated. He saw this enormous fireball, and from a distance of 10 miles, he felt intense heat on his face. And in that moment, Victor Weisskopf believed the atmosphere was on fire and all life on Earth was about to be extinguished. Thankfully, he was wrong. But the fact that there was that level of uncertainty is not comforting. A decade later, we were detonating our first hydrogen bombs, and once again, there was concern because a hydrogen bomb is so much more powerful that the atmosphere would catch on fire and all life on Earth would be extinguished. And calculations were done. We felt fairly confident that wouldn't happen, but we didn't know for sure until the first hydrogen bomb was detonated. To this day, in the year 2014, this extremely dangerous and deadly technology, I would argue, is still on the verge of slipping out of our control.
You're speaking very calmly about all of this. What's your level of anxiety as you researched and wrote this book?
I really felt, I spent 6 years researching and writing the book, and I felt like I had, it was Alice in Wonderland, and I had fallen into the rabbit hole. I could not believe the levels of insanity. And one of the people who I interviewed was the late Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, who, when he became Secretary of Defense in the Kennedy administration, became terrified by the way our nuclear arsenal was being managed. And he did everything he could to try to bring it under control. In the first week that he was Secretary of Defense, a hydrogen bomb nearly detonated in North Carolina and would have destroyed much of that state and put, you know, lethal radioactivity up the entire eastern seaboard. And that would have put a real damper on the new frontier of John F. Kennedy just a few days after he took office. But in trying to understand from him how this happened, how we had a nuclear arms race that led to our having 32,000 nuclear weapons when it was believed that only 150 to 200 would completely destroy the Soviet Union as a functioning society. He said, you know, basically step by step through this arms race, each step seemed to make sense at the time and just led to a place of total madness. A lot of what's been written about the arms race that's been critical of it has tried to demonize people, demonize the weapons designer. I love the film Dr. Strangelove, but it portrays the people in control of the system as being warmongers, eager to nuke the Soviet Union into oblivion. What I found were a great many patriotic, well-intended people trying to protect this country and trying to control this system. And whatever stress I had in researching it was nothing compared to the stress that they lived day in, day out. When we had all these anti-nuclear protests, particularly in the 1980s, the protesters were arguing that we're on the verge of annihilating mankind. And it's remarkable how many people who were within the system privately thinking the same thing. So it's miraculous in my view that we made it out of the Cold War without losing many cities or even one city to a nuclear weapon. I mean, a city has not been destroyed by a nuclear weapon since Nagasaki in 1945. And I'm quite concerned, as maybe a new Cold War is beginning, that we haven't learned the lessons of the last one.
There's also now stories about, sort of portable nuclear weapons, that you don't need a missile delivery system, that the infrastructure that was built by governments and had safeguards put into it is now sort of completely out of our hands.
Yeah. Well, we built nuclear weapons during the Cold War that were small enough for an individual to carry. We had frogmen who were trained. These weapons weighed about 80 pounds and could be used as to destroy bridges or as landmines. today I'm less concerned about those sorts of small weapons, which I think are pretty much locked up. What I'm concerned about today is the complexity of the system that we have, which is increasingly dependent on computers, and the computers are very old. I'm concerned about the possibility of terrorists stealing a weapon in Pakistan or stealing the fissile material, the bomb-grade uranium and plutonium to make a weapon. And I want to make clear that after 6 years of researching the subject and now a year since the book's come out and speaking about it and meeting with government officials about it, I don't feel like we're doomed. I don't feel like I don't feel apocalyptic. I'm not clinically depressed or heavily medicated as a result of this research. But this is the greatest national security threat that we face. And very few people are thinking about it. And an entire generation has been raised with no knowledge of it. I mean, half the population of the United States either was not yet born or were small children when the Cold War ended, and they know nothing about nuclear weapons. And I think this is, you know, for the 21st century, this is the most important national defense issue, and we need to have a real public debate and discussion about these weapons. And it's starting to happen, but it hasn't quite really taken hold yet.
How old are your kids?
23 and 22.
Do you talk to them about this? Are they aware of this?
They unfortunately are now, because they've had to listen to me talk about it, and they've read my book. But their generation is remarkably unaware of this danger. There was the sense that the Cold War ended and the threat went away, and it really didn't. There are still 16 to 17,000 nuclear weapons in the world, and
if you were to
every one of those weapons is a potential act of mass murder, and we need to get control of these things, these very dangerous, deadly machines, so that a city is never destroyed by one again.
If you took all these weapons and dismantled them, which has been, you know, a problem to think about, is what do you do with the material that's in them?
Yeah. Well, right now we are storing the material, you know, in Oak Ridge. There's a Y-12 facility that is considered the Fort Knox of uranium, where we're locking up this bomb-grade stuff. There are ways that it can be reprocessed so that it can't easily be used to make nuclear weapons. And whereas there's a great risk posed by bomb-grade uranium and plutonium, there's an even greater risk posed by fully assembled nuclear weapons. So we need, you know, I support the abolition of nuclear weapons. I was just reading the other day that when the United Nations was created, the first resolution that was passed in 1946 was about abolishing nuclear weapons. There was an awareness in 1946, because Hiroshima and Nagasaki had just been destroyed. There was this awareness of the danger, and we've forgotten it.
This is a good mnemonic, a good reminder, a good source of information to help you be better informed, and for you and your kids. Command and Control by Eric Schlosser. Thank you very much for being on West Coast Live. More information at WCL.org. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, WCL.org.